Hello, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Robert Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me today is Laura C. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right, Robert. How are you doing?
Fantastic. I think your affiliation has changed since the last time you were on. Is that
it correct? Has, yeah. I've moved to Colby College, so I'm assistant professor of government now.
Where is Colby, exactly?
Colby is in Waterville, Maine. So, central Maine, south of Bangor, north of Augusta.
This may be the first time we've broadcast a Foreign Entanglements episode from Maine.
Fantastic.
Breaking new ground, so.
It's absolutely gorgeous up here. It's fall at this point, so the leaves are changing, and we're getting ready for what will be my first really serious winter. but for now, it's really, really beautiful.
Right, you've been a Texas person in the past.
Yeah, and I was in Atlanta for the last 4 years, so not much of a change there. So this is going to be new.
Right. I mean, no, it's been lovely in Kentucky lately, and there's this nice strip of fall that works, I think, all the way from Maine through Appalachia.
Fantastic!
It's fantastic. So, in any case, what we're here to talk about, we're going to talk about a few subjects. But mostly we are going to talk about, I think, the attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. And so I guess to start off with, where are we now in terms of what we know about the attack, how many attackers have been taken prisoner, et cetera? What is the state of our knowledge with regards to this attack?
Well, it's not very good, and I think that you're seeing, especially from Kenyans on Twitter, who go by the hashtag KOT, there is a lot of frustration with the lack of clear and consistent information coming from government ministers. So, you know, there have been statements, I mean, ever since the crisis started, statements coming from this minister or that minister or this official or that Twitter feed from some government agency saying, giving contradictory information and things that either have yet to be confirmed or in some cases that turned out to not be true. So I think that, you know, what we're dealing with is a situation that even though the immediate threat is over, the site is not cleared. There are apparently the whole building is booby trapped. They seem to be conducting quite a few controlled explosions to take those things out. I know some people near who live near Westgate in Nairobi were reporting explosions this morning on Twitter that they were hearing. So it's kind of an ongoing situation. We did get last night Al-Shabaab kind of got immediately blamed for the attack, and then there was a pushback against that. Said no, maybe it was Al-Qaeda. There's been a lot of infighting in Al-Shabaab over the last couple of years, and so a couple weeks ago we had the American jihadi killed as part of that infighting. But the guy who has kind of come out on top of this is a guy named Godane, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. I apologize to our Somali friends. But Godane has consolidated control, and last night he put out a statement saying that they take responsibility for this, and basically that the Kenyans need to be on guard because they're not going to stop until Kenya gets out of Somalia, which, of course, is the thing that prompted all of this in the first place.
So let's take a step back briefly. So one of the reasons that this mall, well, I think we're going to take several steps back, but our first step back, one of the reasons why the mall is so booby-trapped, because it really has taken a very long time to clear the mall of the attackers, right? I mean, something along the lines of 4 or 5 days. Is that my recollection? And that's part of the ambiguity and the smoke with respect to this, is that for a long time it seemed like the attack was simply ongoing because they were holed up, essentially being besieged in Westgate Mall.
Right, and they were hiding out apparently primarily in the grocery store, the Nakumat, on the bottom floor, which is an enormous facility. And also, you know, conveniently, it's a grocery store, so they had plenty of water, plenty of sustenance. As it appears, you know, there have been some leaks from Western intelligence and criminal investigation officials who've leaked to, like, the New York Times and the Washington Post and other organizations. It seems that they had been able somehow to preposition quite a bit of equipment and ammunition in this facility. So they were not just going in with what they had on their bodies, and they were prepared to hold out for several days. I mean, I think that you know, they probably knew quite realistically that this was a suicide mission, but they were able to secure this enormous facility, at least initially, or attack it and make it insecure enough that they could take control of a particular area of it. So the reports have varied on how many dead attackers there are. The most reliable and latest thing that I've seen is 5, possibly 6. And then the Kenyan authorities say that they have arrested 11 suspected people involved in it. But several of those were arrested at the airport. And it's not, and maybe all of them, we don't know, but it's not actually clear that they were involved. It may just be, you know, someone who looked kind of suspicious who happened to be at the airport that afternoon. It's really, really unclear who those individuals are and what happened to the rest of the people who were not at the airport, but who were inside the mall.
Because there have to be, you know, I mean, even for the initial reports, there are more than 5 gunmen, right? There are more than 5 attackers. And so somebody, they're between dead and arrested, especially if all these people have been arrested at the airport, then there has to be, there's some gap there. And so there needs to be
somebody. And there are some witnesses who report that they saw attackers change clothes and, and leave pretending to be, pretending to be victims, like had their hands in the air and all those kinds of things. So, you know, there's I'm sure a huge manhunt going on for suspects in that. I mean, one of the good things is that the mall does have security cameras.
Right.
So there is quite a bit of direct footage of the individuals involved in this. On the victim side of things, we know that I think the last count I saw was 64, 68 confirmed dead, but the Kenya Red Cross has a list of missing individuals and the numbers on that have varied some as well, but it's around 50 to 60 people who have registered that their relatives are unaccounted for. So I think that, you know, when the building is finally cleared, and the other thing is that the Kenyan security forces apparently fired some RPGs inside the mall, and that caused the upper 3 floors to collapse. So the building has collapsed internally. And so that'll make, of course, recovery of remains and of anybody who might have, you know, survived, might have found a really good hiding place and made it through. It's going to take a while to find those individuals.
Right. Now, what was the clientele of this mall like, right? Because this wasn't sort of your typical Kenyan mall, right? I mean, this was very upscale and catered to sort of Kenyan upper class and also expatriates and so forth. Is that, or at least that's what I've heard. Is that correct?
Well, that's kind of the story that goes out. And certainly, I mean, for people who are there on a regular basis and spend money, a lot of money there, that's the clientele. But it's really, I mean, the malls in Kenya are very much a democratizing force. Correct. And they're open to everyone. And they really fill the social function of public spaces. I mean, most Kenyans do not, either they don't have or they choose not to because of security issues, spend time in parks or, you know, arenas, that kind of thing. Right. You don't have the kind of public gathering spaces outside of the malls. And so, you know, for young kids, teenagers, young adults, the mall is it, and that stretches across a wide variety of socioeconomic classes. Everybody shops at Nakumat eventually. Right. I mean, it's a chain. There are several of them around the city, but I think that you have to look at this as something that stretches across strata of society. And of course, I mean, you do have people who worked at the mall, who we certainly wouldn't consider, you know, wealthy expatriates, but there are people who are making a living and going back home at night and, you know, middle class and working class families. I mean, this has a significant effect across the society and across ethnic groups as well. I mean, that's another thing. I think we're seeing a lot of calls for unity across Kenya's ethnic groups, which is, you know, do not always get along on political questions. But there's a real sense of solidarity and a sense of you know, kind of indignation about the injustice of this and how horrible it really was.
Now, on that point, I've also seen, and I should say that you know, you've been following this story since it began on Twitter, and you've been tweeting out lots of good links, and you've been tweeting out lots of other people, and maybe at the end we can sort of talk about, in addition to the KOT hashtag, but like some other important Twitter feeds to follow that are sort of good about supplying up-to-date information. But there is also a substantial and fairly new Somali expatriate community in Kenya, I understand, and maybe you can correct me here, that sort of developed since the collapse of the Somali state. And there's some question about the relationship between that community and Al-Shabaab and these particular attacks. Or are people talking about that yet? Is there any sort of effort at making attribution or sort of divining between a domestic versus a foreign source for the attacks?
Yeah, so, well, so maybe I should start with kind of the history of Somalis in Kenya. It's a little bit more complicated than just migrants coming after the collapse of the Somali state, although certainly that's part of the story. But Somalis as an ethnic group are nomadic. It's a clan-based structure. It's the borders of what we call Somalia are not reflective of and never have been reflective of the historical area where Somalis lived. And part of that includes the portions of northeastern Kenya, where you have very large populations of people of Somali ethnicity, but who are Kenyan citizens and whose ancestors, you know, have been grazing their livestock in Kenya for centuries. So you have a very substantial population of people who are Somali Kenyans. But yeah, I mean the insecurity, the obvious, you know, if you could get out of Somalia for many years there, you did. And there's a very large population that has developed over the last 20 years. Most well known in a neighborhood of Nairobi that's called Eastleigh. So Eastleigh is the kind of Somali community in the epicenter of the Somali community in urban Kenya. In the past, I mean that. So there's, you know, because they're migrants and because of the instability in Somalia, because of the various attacks that Kenyans have suffered, I mean, I think it's really important to remember that this is not the first time that Shabaab or allied elements have gone after Kenya. It's just much more visible because it happened in Nairobi and because it was on such a large scale. But northeastern Kenya is quite insecure and has been for a very long time. But the Eastleigh community, they're kind of convenient scapegoats. And the police in Kenya, who do not have a reputation of being the most scrupulous individuals or honest, would be another
professional.
Another word. Yeah, they're not professional, and so the Somalis are convenient scapegoats to go after for shakedowns. You know, we'll stop harassing you if you pay us off. But also, anytime there's something that goes wrong in the city, some kind of criminal activity, there's always a chance that whether there's evidence for it or not, someone in the Somali community will be blamed for whatever has happened. And so you have kind of a very uneasy, lacking in trust, for good reason, relationship between Somalis in Kenya and those who are not. So the question is, you know, the vast majority of people who live in Eastleigh are just trying to survive. They're running businesses, they are cooking food for their families and you know, trying to find a way to get their kids into school and survive. People have varying immigration statuses. Some are undocumented, so that makes them another easy target for the police.
Right.
Some are citizens. But there are some people in that community, and there's one imam in particular. I can't remember his name, but there is this imam that's of concern who is based in Eastleigh, who has a more radical ideology, and there is a lot of suspicion that he's involved in that. There are also questions about the relationship to the piracy issue. There's a lot of suspicion that pirate money flows into Eastleigh, and this really showed up a couple years ago when there was, or maybe months ago, when there was sort of a property boom in Eastleigh. So you had these people building enormous houses, and where did they get that money is the big question. And that drove up land prices, and so, of course, shut other people out of the market, which was quite upsetting to many of the ordinary people.
Right, but my immediate sense about this would be, the sort of the radical imam aside, right, that, but especially, like, I mean, the pirate money would have no interest in being associated with something like this, right? I mean, sort of an association of pirate money or pirate networks with an attack like this would be terrible for everyone involved, right?
I mean, that's the assumption. I think you can never say that anything is impossible in
right.
Somalia. And I'm not an expert on Somalia, so I won't go down into that question. But, you know, that's certainly something that the U.S. and Western allies who've been trying to combat piracy have been worried about for a very long time, is that some pirates would link up with jihadis in Somalia. And I want to say there was some evidence of that in sort of certain groups, but you have to remember that the pirates are not unified actors.
Right,
they're gangs. They're criminal syndicates, basically. And so you can't really speak of the Somali pirates as a whole and have that mean a lot.
Right. Now, with respect to some of the sort of the longer term relationship between Al Shabaab and Kenya, of course we know right now that the most immediate problem between the two is sort of the Kenyan occupation, or sort of the Kenyan military offensive into Somalia that drove Al Shabaab out of several key towns and so forth. But even before that, there was sort of a negative and violent relationship, right? I mean, there were sort of al-Shabaab attacks happening, especially in the insecure parts of Kenya, even before the major Kenyan offensive into Somalia, to my recollection.
Right. There were like, cross-border raids,
right.
That kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Right, and that sort of, that served as much of the justification for Kenya's military action into Somalia, which we all remember because they would tweet the F-5 strikes and so forth.
Right, right.
Just the
move your cattle to the Somali herders.
Right.
I'm sure we're on Twitter watching the alerts for when bombs were going to start falling from the sky.
Right. But the element of al-Shabaab taken responsibility for this, the leadership which has taken responsibility for this, has that been characterized sort of straightforwardly in terms of retribution or vengeance for the occupation, for the Kenyan occupation of parts of Somalia, or sort of in more abstract terms? Or, I mean, does this seem like, tit for tat violence?
I mean, the statement that came out last night was very explicit.
Mm-hmm.
That this is in retaliation, and that it will not stop until Kenya gets out of Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's of course the real story is a little bit more complicated, right? Because one of the reasons the Kenyans are in Somalia is the genuine threat to their borders that they were responding for. But another one is because they're a United States security cooperation partner.
Right.
We have a long history of collaboration with the Kenyan military, training their troops and. Particularly on anti-terrorism issues, and this goes back to the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy.
Right.
Long time concerns about parts of Kenya being under threat or even becoming possible kind of like desert havens for terrorists, and certainly the proximity to Somalia is the most important thing there. And so I would find it very difficult to believe that the Kenyans chose to go into Somalia without very strong urging and backing.
Right.
And assurances from various elements of the United States defense and intelligence structure. I mean, we're pretty confident in saying that there are sort of the CIA paramilitary type,
mm-hmm.
special forces, people from JSOC, operating in Somalia right now, and
right.
certainly they are, if they're there, they're definitely collaborating with the Kenyans. And so, al-Shabaab is aware of these issues and certainly see this as an opportunity to strike at the people behind the Kenyans as well.
That's interesting.
And I think part of their goal is to get the Kenyans to break with the Americans, because, there's no way America is going to send a full-fledged force
right.
openly into Somalia. And so, from the al-Shabaab point of view, it makes sense to talk the Kenyan or to try to scare the Kenyans out of involvement in this crisis.
It's interesting because I just finished Mark Mazzetti's Way of the Knife, which is of course about sort of the growth and transformation of the CIA and JSOC overs in the wars on terror. And to my recollection, and see, the problem is that I've read so much and I can never remember who wrote what, but he actually drew a distinction between sort of very limited U.S. support for the Kenyan offensive in comparison with the Ethiopian offensive of 2007, right, where sort of the U.S. fingerprints were all over it. It was quite clear that this was a sort of a joint U.S.-Ethiopian operation.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if he was agnostic as to whether, the United States was just better at covering up its tracks this time around, or if the genesis seemed to come much more from the... Well, obviously Ethiopia wanted to invade Somalia for its own reasons back then, but sort of, Kenya coming up with its own good reasons for its occupation of parts of Somalia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I don't know enough to know what the level of support is, but it seems entirely reasonable that there was more in that old invasion. But mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the key issue is that it's still there, and of course, right. I mean, there are some questions too about the capacity of Ethiopian troops versus the Kenyan troops, and you know what they're kind of able to do on their own versus needing some assistance from outside and in more overt ways. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it really, it's going to be a period of soul searching. I think one of the good things that we've seen is that the Kenyan authorities have been very consistent in calling for citizens of Kenya not to target Somalis. I mean, there have been clear and consistent messages across Twitter and through other media that you don't need to jump to assumptions. Don't start rioting. Don't start targeting people just because of their ethnicity.
Right.
And the sense that, you know, that this can be stood up against, and that Al-Shabaab's efforts at intimidation are not going to help. And I mean, I think that speaks to some other analysis by people who know the region much better than I do, like Ken Menkaus, who's probably the preeminent expert on Somalia in the U.S. Ken had a piece that came out on Sunday with Think Progress.
Mm-hmm.
And he argued that this is actually a sign of desperation on the part of Shabaab, that they don't see any way to survive just on their own. And so what they need to do is divide Kenyans and divide Somalis in particular, and, you know, really cause Somali Kenyans and Somalis in Kenya to feel more marginalized, and they think that that will get them to kind of rally to their cause.
Right.
But, you know, they probably didn't do themselves any favors by killing some Muslims in this attack. And, right. I mean, one of the things that came out in that statement last night, too, is that there had been reports from witnesses that the people who attacked Westgate were trying to sort Muslims and non-Muslims, like by asking people to recite Quran verses or, you know, say prayers and that kind of thing. And the Shabaab confirmed that last night, said it really did happen. And but there was one case where several witnesses watched two women or a mother and her daughter or something like that perform admirably but be killed. And they screamed, you know, why did you do that? And he said, well, because they're not wearing hijab.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're putting yourself in the position of deciding who's a faithful Muslim and who's not, that tends to not really make you particularly popular,
right.
Especially if you're killing, you know, people that the group that you would like to win support from
right.
have something in common with.
Now, I thought that article was very interesting for a couple of reasons. One, sort of being that we are, or at least I am, and I think probably many people are sort of reluctant to accept this was just a sign of desperation, sort of in context of living through the war in Iraq, right, where sort of every successful
yeah.
terrorist attack was met by Donald Rumsfeld intoning, it's just dead-enders launching an attack
yeah.
of desperation. But in this case, you know, there's logic to that. I mean, right, not only has Al-Shabaab sort of suffered a series of significant military defeats, mostly at the hands of the Kenyans, but also at AU troops and also to other Somali actors. You know, it can still act in Mogadishu, but it doesn't control Mogadishu. But, I mean, to my recollection, the argument was made that the leadership itself was fragmenting, and that you had leadership conflicts and you had sort of internecine conflicts within the organization. And so in that context, what, you know, this kind of seems like is middle management conducting or trying to outbid other, or would it make sense to say that this is something along the lines of middle management, you know, competing with other middle management in Al-Shabaab or different factions, sort of fighting for influence and using this as a leadership bid?
So that goes beyond my knowledge, but I mean, I will say that I think you're right, that there's a lot of evidence that, you know, Shabaab is suffering real setbacks. This is not just kind of pep talk stuff. I mean, I think for once in Somalia, we are kind of at the point where people don't try to cheerlead or gloss over things
right.
anymore because everybody knows that's a lie. But my understanding of the power struggle in Shabaab is that Godane has come out on top.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to, I mean, he's claiming credit for being sort of the one who planned this operation and came up with it. So, you know, whether that's significant or not, I don't know. I mean, right. There've also been pretty widespread reports that a lot of the foreign fighters who had shown up a few years ago in Somalia and joined the fight there have left. These sort of jihadis, you know, from various places in the Middle East, Yemen, and that they've kind of either moved on to the sort of newer, sexier jihads and, in Mali or in Libya or in Syria. They don't have the kind of, Shabab doesn't have the kind of international strength and support that it had before. And Godane in particular is not particularly strong. Not somebody who is well known, in Al-Qaeda structures, and not somebody who has a high degree of respect, at least yet. Now, if he really is the one who's pulled this off, of course, that's gonna help his status within those structures.
This actually, strange life, though. I mean, the last time you and I met briefly was at APSA, and I was on a panel that was sort of very much dealt with these internal leadership struggles within terrorist organizations, and that's one reason I asked the question, because it was on the mind. Then getting back to this, this is a sign of desperation from al-Shabaab, that may be true, but this seems to have been a really fantastically executed, planned and executed terrorist operation, right? I mean, they did a really good job here, especially if, in target selection, in terms of if they were able to pre-position munitions and food and everything else. It seems very professional to me. I mean, it looks like they really knew what they were doing when they, throughout the operation. And I guess we will know more about that, if we find another 30 dead terrorists in there, dead fighters, whatever, then maybe we revise our conclusions, right? But if they carried it out with relatively low loss of life and then, were able to infiltrate people out, as is at least possible, that's not a sign of a really desperate organization. That seems well done.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the reasons I was fairly skeptical over the weekend al-Shabaab. So the word went out that al-Shabaab was claiming credit, but it was those claims were based on sort of Twitter feeds that, were questionably al-Shabaab, or who is it within al-Shabaab that's saying these things. It's really only been the last couple of days that has seemed to firm up. And at one point, somebody was saying, the Kenyan authorities think it was actually al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that the force seems to have been multinational in some way. You have a lot of Kenyan witnesses, or in general witnesses to it, who insisted that many of the attackers that they saw were not Kenyan and were not Black Africans. Mm-hmm. So now, not Black Africans, many people would count Somali in that. I mean, of course, you get into the social construction of race, but and you also, what do people understand in a moment of panic and trauma?
Right. I mean, all we have to do is sort of go back to the Navy Yard attack, which happens at exactly the same time in the first day.
Right.
Before we harp on the unprofessionalism of the Nairobi police, let us recollect that the chief of the Washington D.C. police at one point went on TV saying, "We think that there's a white guy and a Black guy. If you know anybody who meets that description, then
right,
please
and
contact
like in
the police."
In military uniform, right?
Right.
Exactly. Don't get on the metro at Pentagon that day.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and that I think points to a deeper truth, is that as much as we would all like to have answers immediately in a crisis like this, figuring out a terrorist attack and figuring out what really happened and who did what is extraordinarily difficult, and it takes time and it requires patience. Now, if you're the family member of someone who's missing, you need to know if your family member is dead or alive, but the sort of investigative part, it'll be a long time before we really know what happened, and I think that the death toll is going to get much worse before we're really able to move on.
Right. Now, so, and I don't know the extent to which you have your finger on the pulse of Kenyan foreign policy attitudes, but do you have any sense of how the occupation of parts of Somalia, or perhaps even, to put it in more general terms, the current foreign policy relationship between Kenya and the rump Somalia, how popular is this operation? Is it something that, like, terrorist attacks like this, you know, is there some fertile ground, do you think, within Kenyan politics to say, look, why should we be doing this? This is a terrible idea. Let's maybe give it a decent interval, but then let's withdraw and, wipe our hands of this Somalia business. Is any of that, to your knowledge, sort of compelling within the Kenyan political context?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I am not a Kenyan foreign policy expert, haven't really. I mean, they had a presidential election earlier this year, mm-hmm. and to the best of my knowledge, that was never a major point of contention for most voters. I mean, it was probably discussed in the presidential debates, but mm-hmm. The main focus was on moving past the 2007 electoral violence.
Right.
And electing somebody who was going to, you know, improve economic development and help keep the Kenyan economy strong and also cut down on corruption within the governing ranks and try to move toward a society more based in the rule of law. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think you had many or any candidates or voters whose appeals or choices were made on the basis of the Somalia thing. Now, mm-hmm. could some opposition politicians see this as an opening? Probably. But at the same time, you have to remember that they have constituents who are in immediate danger from Shabaab. And certainly Kenyans want to protect the territorial integrity of Kenya's borders. I mean, I really haven't seen any kind of uprising. There's a lot of frustration right now with the security services. I was seeing a call on Twitter just before we got on here to fire the head of the intelligence services for not predicting this or finding out about it in advance. But I think the Kenyans, at least the class of Kenyans who are vocal and involved in social media and getting their independent opinions out there, they're much more concerned with internal issues, with corruption, with incompetence, mm-hmm. Than they are with sort of the value of the policy decision. Although, you know, I think there is potential that this opens up a wider debate. Of course, we're in a kind of unique situation with Kenya in that both of its executive leaders are undergoing trial or about to go on trial at the International Criminal Court for their alleged roles in the 2007 violence. So,
but now they've been allowed to travel. Did I read that there have been sort of special allowances made for their travel because of this?
Yeah. So Ruto, who is the deputy, mm-hmm. his trial had already started up at mm-hmm. The Hague, and they suspended it on Monday to allow him to travel back to deal with the crisis. Mm-hmm. And Kenyatta's is scheduled to start in a couple months, but it's not underway yet. So,
could we take this, because I'm also interested. I don't know. If you read the same thing, and actually the Lincoln Amendment momentarily escapes me, but sort of take this in step to, or at least an argument I've seen, is that there is sort of growing, I don't know if discontent is the right word, skepticism within a variety of different African communities and African political communities with respect to the work of the ICC and the utility of the ICC, sort of in terms of acting as a hindrance or an impediment to sort of the practice of everyday politics. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and it's definitely, I mean, skepticism is not the word, it's a hatred.
Right.
And a feeling that Africans are being unfairly and disproportionately targeted, mm-hmm. And that politicians in particular, I think a lot of the politicians who joined the Rome Statute mm-hmm. are people who are no longer in power, who maybe did it for reasons of their own, and then their successors don't necessarily see the value in it. But also, some leaders, I think, expected that the way the court would be used would be to prosecute people who were problematic to themselves.
Right.
So, I mean, Joseph Kabila in Congo is probably the best example of this, right? The way he dispatches of his political rival, Jean-Pierre Bemba, is to mm-hmm. hand Bemba over to the court and get him out of Congo completely. And that was, I mean, you know, if that's your goal, if you want to have a kind of monopolistic politics,
right.
It's a really great way to get rid of a political rival. But since the court has become more willing to pursue even people in significant positions of power, you definitely have seen a lot more resistance. So The African Union has scheduled an extraordinary summit on just this topic, on whether AU countries should quit the statute and pull out of the ICC altogether. I think it's supposed to be next week or the week after. It may be delayed because of the Kenya situation, but it's, you know, they're serious about it. Paul Kagame dedicated a chunk of his UNGA speech yesterday to railing against the ICC, which Rwanda is not a party to the Rome Statute. So it was interesting to see Kagame railing against something that, you know, he's not subject to any jurisdiction of. But yeah, I mean, so the court has, you know, it's this complicated mix of the court's politics and the Security Council's politics, and then the politics and conflicts in countries all over the world. Of course, by appointing Fatou Bensouda as the new prosecutor, the second prosecutor of the court, so they appointed an African woman from the Gambia. That was supposed to be kind of a salvo, I guess is the word, or something to kind of be reassuring to Africans that, look, you know, this is not just targeting Africa, and if it were, and why would an African be pursuing this? Of course, the counter argument to that is that everyone so far who's been tried by the court, and everyone who's been indicted is African. Most of those people pretty evidently, you know, allegedly guilty of of gross human rights violations. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's no way. I think that Kenyatta and Ruto would like to downplay their role in the electoral violence. But that's why we have a trial process. Right. And that's why we try to get witnesses to come and speak on it to determine guilt. The other issue is that the ICC only takes jurisdiction of a case when the domestic courts refuse to prosecute it or are incapable of doing so. And so I think that, you know, for the African leaders who are considering pulling out of this, they have a lot of really tough questions to answer in regards to, okay, if it's not going to be the ICC, then who's going to hold people accountable for committing war crimes, for committing crimes against humanity, especially when you have heads of state allegedly involved in these activities.
Right, because there was a tone of mockery there when you talked about Kabila's strategy for moving people out of the domestic opponents out of Congo, right? And you know, we get into even new philosophical side with respect to the dirty hands problem and so forth. But it's not obviously absurd, sort of in the context of political stability. You know, the opportunity to have to be able to move these conflicts to an entirely different venue so that, you know, they don't start additional conflicts domestically, right? I mean, there is a stability interest here, or a theoretical
transitional, getting rid
of people you don't like, right? But that's...
Yeah. Right, I mean, in Congo, the Congolese courts, quite frankly, there's a lot of talk of, like, mixed courts and those kinds of... They're not capable of giving a fair trial to alleged suspects, and if you're a victim, you are not going to feel that justice was served, that your interests were protected,
right?
If you go through a trial in a domestic court in that situation. I mean, I think that the court has really screwed up by not indicting people who clearly are engaged in gross human rights violations in other places. You know, the probably the best thing the Security Council could do, although they can't get it through, but, you know, someone needs to... Syria is the clear answer. Surely there is someone. Maybe it doesn't have to be Assad, but someone in Syria needs to be indicted, and that would save a lot of headaches for the ICC to have some kind of non-African guilt. But the other issue is that a lot of the sort of international criminal human rights cases outside of Africa predate the ICC's establishment and are being tried at the old special court system. So the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, the Cambodian court, right? I mean, there are people who are not African who are on trial in international courts for war crimes and crimes against humanity. They're just not being tried at the specific ICC court. But that just has to do with timelines and when things happened and when things started.
Right. Yeah, no, you mentioned the Syrian, it does seem to me that there could be some sort of coalition towards, finding a fall guy for the Assad regime who's not Assad, who could be indicted by the ICC, right? You know, that even the regime and the Russians could come up with some hapless colonel to blame for the particular chemical weapons attack, right? Who could, you know, and then everyone could agree, oh, well, let's send this guy to the ICC and that'll, you know, paper over differences. Right.
Yeah, but that's probably not one of Assad's top priorities right now. Right,
no, that's probably.
Getting the referral through the Security Council, I think, is the major trick. And,
right.
and I mean, I can understand that even Western officials who are deeply committed to mm-hmm. to the ICC and its power don't want to spend diplomatic capital on that when there are other issues at stake.
All right. Well, you know, we had talked about doing a few other things, like more Pan-African arguments. But yeah, I actually think that keeping this one focused on Kenya is a good idea. You know, is there anything else you want to say about Kenya? And then maybe we could do, in some sense, because I think Congo deserves its own discussion and CAR deserves its own discussion.
I don't know that I have much more to add. I think that, you know, Kenya, but I mean, I will say Kenya is a place where, you know, you've had over the last 15 years or so, the explosive growth of a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real middle class. It's people who have limited disposable income, but they do have disposable income. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of people in that group have no interest in seeing the country become destabilized. They don't want to become like some of their neighbors. They
right.
don't want, and you have a much more sort of cosmopolitan urban population, that is sophisticated, that is, you know, reporting news on its own, that is, able to critique and evaluate, bad reporting on the country by foreign outlets.
Right.
And, you know, these are all really positive steps. And I do think that while there are clearly still a lot of problems in the intelligence sector and in the police and in the response to this, I mean, I will say that, you know, looking at how they handled this crisis versus how they would have handled a similar crisis 10 years ago,
right.
Clearly these people were trained to deal with a terror threat, with a mass casualty event. 10 years ago, I could have seen them storming a building and killing just as many civilians as they did attackers.
Right.
In the effort to
we also
to
know
deal
that
with it quickly,
the,
but
the Russian
you know, this,
solution,
the,
but.
Yeah, I mean, but this, there were clear signs that, you know, there was an understanding of hostage situations,
mm-hmm.
starting negotiations, the need to be very, very careful not to accidentally hit civilians. And that's progress, and it's not perfect, but change is incremental in
right.
these kinds of things. And, you know, it would be a real shame if the fear that comes out of this were allowed to derail the progress that Kenya is making and to keep the prosperity that's been developing over the last decade or so from spreading to a wider sector of the population. So,
well, I mean, for people who study sort of institutional, I mean, not just from a policy point of view, but also from an academic point of view, for people who study sort of institutional evolution and institutional dynamics, it should be really interesting to see what the effect of sort of this will have, that this event will have on Kenya's security services, right? Whether we'll see, whether we will detect a more noticeably professionalized security sector and police sector in Kenya. It'll be interesting
to
watch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that'll be very interesting to watch. And certainly, you know, they'd had a lot of training, but they'd never had to deal with anything
right.
like this on this scale. And so now you have people who are experienced, hopefully there will be an exercise of sort of examining the response, learning lessons, and improvement. I mean, I think you need things like an improved commitment to sort of refresher training and regular, regular, not just refreshing on what you learned the first time, but also,
right.
Learning what's new and learning about new techniques that a lot of that doesn't exist in Kenya. Right now, but you do need more professionalization. I mean, it is still. I lived in Kenya in 98 as a
mm-hmm.
student, and at that time, it was possible to like rent a uniform from an off-duty police officer and use it to set up a roadblock and extort
uh-huh.
people, or,
right.
or you know, pretend to be the police when you're.
It's how you made it through
house.
Your second semester.
It is not how I made it through my second semester, but that's apparently still possible in some quarters. And you know, get it, how do you get past that in your level of institutional evolution? And how do you, get a truly professionalized police force, I hope will be big questions on the agenda for Kenyan politicians. And I would suggest that one of the ways to do that is to pay people better,
right,
and to make sure that they have adequate housing and adequate, you know, are able to send their children to good schools. And because if you do that, you're going to attract better people for the jobs, and you're going to attract them for the longer term. And that's how you build up professionalization.
Right.
But that's going to require some Kenyan politicians to reevaluate their commitment to using public dollars for the public good. So.
All right, well, Laura, thank you very much for being with us, and foreign attendance viewers, thank you much for being with us, and hopefully we will have the opportunity to do this again, sometime soon.
Thanks, Robert. It was a lot of fun.
All right, wonderful.
Okay.